You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
From the heart of where innovation, money, and power collide in Silicon Valley and beyond, this is Bloomberg Technology with Caroline Hyde and Ed Ludlow.
I'm Ed Ludlow in San Francisco. Caroline Hyde is off. This is Bloomberg Technology. Coming up on the show, we get the outlook for technology stocks with Denise Chisholm of Fidelity. As risk on bets take hold, we are trading in the green. Plus, we'll discuss the state of retail trading and beyond with Robinhood CEO Vlad Tenev as the company expands into the credit card business. And we'll sit down with Mike Novogratz of Galaxy Digital to talk all things crypto ahead of the Sam Bankman-Fried sentencing, which is tomorrow. I want to talk about the outlook for technology shares in particular with Denise Chisholm, Director of Quantitative Market Strategy at Fidelity Investments. Let's start with Baltimore. Denise, let me put it this way. You know, you've modeled the prior shocks of the pandemic, the impact that had on supply chain. Do you consider Baltimore a data point that may show up down the line in these markets, or are you kind of sanguine about the lasting effect here?
I would say more in the sanguine camp. When you see supply shocks that affect the overall economy, they need to be a hit of about 1.5% to 2.5% of consumers' income historically to tip us into a recessionary impact. We're far from those measures probably on this. It doesn't mean that there won't be some interim issues, but I think that there are other cross currents that are less inflationary than potentially what we're seeing from Baltimore as well.
You know, I'm just considering, you know, materially what's happening there on the ground. I know Amazon has warehouses, but the scale seems small. Look, it is March 27th. Unbelievably, we're almost at the end of the first quarter. Two consecutive quarters of gains. If you use the NASDAQ 100 as our kind of technology focused proxy, what's your assessment of where we are in the technology sector right now as we approach the beginning of April? Unbelievably.
Yeah, statistically, it almost looks like it's early innings to me. I think that there was a lot of concern from investors that technology stocks have moved too far too fast. And what you're seeing when the earnings came through, they more than delivered on the earnings that were expected. And the hockey stick we've seen in terms of the second derivative of earnings improvement is really something we haven't seen since coming out of the pandemic. And then before that, coming out of the financial crisis. So despite the fact that we didn't have a recession, this looks like a recessionary earnings recovery, historically speaking. And when you go back and you look at those, they tend to be very durable and lasting. So when you backtest all of what we've seen, and it's not just from the Mag 7, but when you look at that, it usually is the beginning of something that is durable into year two and year three. And I think that's what investors need to start considering, not only for technology, but for the broader market.
So it's a question of weighing up data against your own sentiment, right? And when I was reflecting on earnings season, so much of the story was around artificial intelligence. And you see so many of the infrastructure names, not just NVIDIA, I'm talking about the server design companies, others in the stack, basically giving us a strong outlook for this year. But actually, you know, at EPS level, outlook level, the numbers seemed good as well. Which was the more important factor?
No, I think that the more important factor was that it was across the board and diffuse, and that it was through all of technology. I mean, we have data going back from most of technology to the 90s and even some to the 60s. But when you look at the breakpoints in terms of operating margin expansion, which I really think is the driver behind the earnings recovery for technology as a sector, you'll see from the 10th percent breakpoint to the 90th percent breakpoint at the median level, all operating margins are now actually improving. And that's really the diffuse driver for the entire sector. And this is improvement off a pretty high level. There is nothing like that we saw in 99 or 2000. We're generating a lot more free cash flow in the sector off a higher operating margin base. We did see a contraction in operating margins, and now we're seeing that beginning stages of recovery.
And yet, despite us talking about FOMO in January, I'm talking about the fund managers' surveys, net positions, I'm seeing a lot of outflows from technology funds. Why are you not worried about that?
Yeah, so when you look at it, there was, I think, the biggest outflow ever in the last month that we've seen historically. And that's true on a nominal basis, right? But when you rescale it for percent of assets, or just even you rescale it for inflation, it starts to look fairly innocuous relative to sort of the headlines that investors were reading. And even though it is a bottom quartile level, so meaning that there was a significant level of outflows we haven't seen in quite some time, when you try and correlate that to anything in terms of relative performance, either past relative performance or even future relative performance, you can't see a very consistent correlation. If anything, over the last 10 years, it's actually been a bigger buy signal than a sell signal. So as much as, yes, it's concerning and headlines are concerning, I do think data can always help to say, okay, well, what are the relationships here? And do I feel secure in terms of betting on this as a top predictor? And I would say, based on my data, I would say be careful with that bet.
So one of the reasons I love having you on the program, Denise, is that you make your assessment and you review your model in the context of historical data. And you talk about data going back to the 90s. I know it's a single name, but Nvidia wasn't doing this in the 90s. There was not a euphoria around GPU and the ripple effect that goes to the rest of the server design, memory chips, the energy component of what's going on. Just explain to our audience how you model what I believe is kind of a phenomenon, right? Something that is new.
Right. No, it's always different, right? There are absolute differences cycle to cycle, and you know, you picked a big one. But sometimes you can look at the differences and actually find out if those differences or the anomaly is predictive in and of itself. And you said we've never seen this before. Well, we did see bubble-like conditions in the late 90s, right? I mean, we saw it with different stocks, different names. But there was a disconnect in terms of valuation relative to earnings growth or free cash flow generation. This cycle, we're seeing the exact opposite, you would argue, is that it's the free cash flow generation that's actually the anomaly, not the disconnect in terms of valuation. So when you put that in a historical model, I'll say, it looks like a less risky proposition. I think the riskiest propositions historically, and we can talk about the 90s, or we can talk about it in other sectors as well, is when you see a clear disconnect between fundamentals and valuation. And right now, you're not actually seeing that in a lot of the stocks and in the technology sector as a whole.
I wasn't doing this in the 90s, admittedly, but I have your analysis, so I can go back and look. Denise Chisholm of Fidelity Investments, it's great to catch up and have you back on Bloomberg Technology. Thank you. Now, coming up on the show, we're going to bring you the latest on former President Donald Trump's social media company as shares extend gains for a second day. I also am taking a look at shares of Rumble. We're actually modestly higher, 0.4%, but remember, this is a stock that rose 15% or so in Tuesday's session, all on the back of comments from Rumble's CEO, who went to X, another social media platform, to talk about the relationship between Rumble, which is a more conservative Peter Thiel-backed platform, and Truth Social, or Trump Media and Technology Group. It's amazing what a public comment will do to a stock 0.2% higher today. This is Bloomberg Technology.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop. customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Shares of former President Donald Trump's social media company are higher for a second day after surging in their first trading day as a public company. I want to bring in Bloomberg's Bailey Lipschultz. This is a de-SPAC, a reverse merger with a blank check company. The point is it's now trading. And Bloomberg does what it does best, is look at the numbers that are given in the regulatory filings tied to it. Bloomberg's looking at the numbers. The market seems to be looking past the numbers.
Correct. Ed, but you cover technology companies. This is a company that if you use a traditional metric, let's say price to sales, it trades at a north of 2,200 multiple. For context, NVIDIA is closer to 38. The company lost about $30 million in the first 9 months of last year, revenue of just $3.4 million. But as I punch up the ticker on the terminal, $8.8 billion valuation, Ed. So whether or not it's a meme stock or however you want to categorize it, it definitely is not trading on a hindsight 12-month valuation.
I think back to 2020, that was what prompted me to look into Nikola, right, and Trevor Milton, that I was reading what they were saying about their financials, and it just didn't add up. So we got digging, and the rest is history, so to speak. Even so, this is a highly anticipated listing, even though it was done via a de-SPAC. What broadly is the investor interest in Trump Media and Technology Group? And just tell us a bit about what the company actually is and does.
So the company's crown jewel is Truth Social, kind of a Twitter lookalike. That is Donald Trump's preferred social media platform. So that's really where he posts and engages with fans and followers. But for just kind of putting apples to apples comparisons, he has about 8.6 million followers on Truth Social. He is about 10 times that on X, even though he's only posted once since January 2021. The big thing, Ed, when you look at this company and you look at kind of the retail chatter that we've been tracking on Truth Social, on Reddit's Wall Street Bets forums, on StockTwits, is that this is seen as kind of a way to back Donald Trump or kind of view him through his push for re-election in the 2024 campaign. And that's why we saw the stock when it was trading under DWAC, the blank checks ticker, jump 88% when Governor DeSantis pulled out of the race. So it really has been heavily tied to his prospects to potentially become president again.
Okay, Bloomberg's Bailey Lipschultz, one of the best out there at reporting on SPACs. Appreciate it. Robinhood, best known for its trading services, is rolling out a credit card to U.S. consumers as it looks to broaden its business to become a more expansive financial services company. Delighted to say that joining us now is Robinhood co-founder and CEO Vlad Tenev. And Vlad, I think we get right to the why. Why you decided to issue a credit card which is offering 3% cash back on basically everything, all categories.
Yeah, thank you for having me. The simple reason is we see an opportunity in the credit card market to build something that's really unique and special. And we wanted to have the best rewards. We wanted to have the best digital experience and the best design. And we're really proud of the work that the team's done, because we're not just business people and technologists, but we also have great artists. And as you can see, the design and the credit card is, I think, the most iconic credit card that's ever been made. So I think people will really enjoy it.
Vlad, we got so many questions for you from our audience when I said you were coming on. A lot of them around the 3% cashback. The first is from Regulatory Nerd on X asking, how are they funding the 3% rewards on the gold card products when consumer credit and debit interchange are much lower than that? Is it PFOF fees or some direct cost on the consumer elsewhere in your ecosystem? Please answer that for us, Vlad.
Yeah, certainly. So as I'm sure it won't be a surprise, we're not going to enter a business without a path to it being a profitable business on a standalone basis. So for the credit card business in and of itself, we generate revenue from the interchange, but also we generate revenue from the lending side of the business. So we don't think this credit card, even though it'll be great for customers that are paying off their balance in full, we also think it's going to be an incredible card for people that are building credit and getting started on their journey. So that's the credit card business as a standalone. We also see, since it's through Robinhood Gold and you have to be a Gold member to qualify for the card, Robinhood Gold members actually, once they join, they adopt our products at a higher rate. Their cash balance and the amount of assets they put into Robinhood is much higher. They're getting all of this great value, including 5% right. APY on your cash, the 3% IRA match, the 1% unlimited deposit boost. So as they're getting this value, the revenue that we make from gold customers is also multiples of non-gold customers. So there's an ecosystem benefit to having all of their finances in one place, not just for the customers, but for Robinhood, the business. And we think that'll accelerate with the credit card.
Vlad, what is your big vision for Robinhood now? You know, the kind of big picture financial services goals. I think about the success of retirement products. You know, the first 12 months were pretty good, and then beginning of this year, really deposits blew up. Tell me what the Robinhood of the future is.
Absolutely, and I'm really glad that you mentioned that, because, yeah, in the first 12 months, we had decent growth with retirement. We got up to about $1.5 billion in assets under custody in the first year. The past 3 months, we've gone from $1.5 billion to $4 billion assets under custody. So the growth has gone through an inflection point. And then what gets us really excited is the actual individual retirement account market in the U.S. has over $14 trillion in assets. So the space is quite big. And even though we're growing quickly, there's just a lot of room to run and a lot of market share to be had. And we have been taking market share, not just on the trading side, but also on the asset side. Robinhood of the future, you look out, you know, over the long run, we'd like to build a platform where for all of our customers, we custody right. all of their financial assets, and all of their financial transactions should go through Robinhood, because we provide so much value across the board.
Vlad, there are still questions about trust. Our other audience questions were about trust. I'm going to read you this one from Corp Report on X. Given the meme stock outrage still in memory in 2021, how do you plan to win and maintain user trust while expanding Robinhood's consumer credit offerings?
Yeah, I mean, we've definitely been listening and learning, and, you know, we've seen our share of movies that came out recently as well. I think, look, the focus is on providing as much value to customers as possible, giving them not just access to like trading tools, but also to the highest quality wealth building tools. We want to help customers build long-term wealth on our platform, and we think we're delivering on that. If you look at the value proposition of Robinhood Gold, in the same way that we've democratized access to trading and investments, we think there's an opportunity to democratize the private client experience and the private wealth experience. You have to have hundreds of thousands of dollars in account balance or net worth at some of these big banks to get access to the finest perks and benefits. With Robinhood Gold, we're providing that experience to you for as little as $5 a month.
Vlad, this is the first time we've had a chance to talk since Dumb Money. And I just want to ask, for Robinhood, for you personally, was that movie a net positive?
Hard to say. I mean, I don't think that it did very well in the box office. But I do think that there is an opportunity to tell the Robinhood story and to focus on the customer story in a way that isn't necessarily pejorative. I mean, I wasn't a big fan of calling it dumb money. I think that sort of makes fun of how sophisticated retail investors have gotten over the past several years. And, you know, without Robinhood, the whole retail investor movement would likely not have happened.
Right.
We're proud to play a role in that, even though we had some learnings along the way.
Robinhood CEO Vlad Tenev on the new credit card on Much More. Really appreciate your time. Thank you. Welcome back to Bloomberg Technology. Ed Ludlow here in San Francisco. A very quick check-in on the markets as we approach the end of the first quarter. Actually, nothing going on in the moment this Wednesday. Basically flat on most major indices, particularly the tech-heavy ones, NASDAQ 100, Philadelphia Semiconductor Index. There are a few interesting stories out there. Fisker is one that we continue to watch. And you can see just above my hand, 2 cents a share, delisted by the NYSE Monday. This morning's news that they're actually savage cutting prices on their remaining inventory to kind of try and save themselves. Go on Bloomberg.com, read about what's happening with Fisker, the EV maker. Nvidia also down 3%. There is so much material and content out there about Nvidia all the time at the moment. It's still continuing to be the leader of the pack, but it is, from a points basis at least, a bit of a drag on some of the indexes, which is why I put it in that board. We're also looking at Bitcoin, as we always do. Over the last 3 days, there's been some interesting trading. You know, you reflected on Monday in the US session, and in Tuesday, there was slightly more volatility and bigger moves. I've reflected over the last few weeks and months. How common is it for Bitcoin to make a sizable move Sunday, for example? Trades 24/7, the impact of Asia trading. But there's a brilliant piece on the Bloomberg Terminal about how we're seeing these moves in US trading now as well. Now, we know on this show, you don't make too much of a short-term move in Bitcoin. There's a much bigger conversation to have. Joining us now to have that conversation is Galaxy Digital founder and CEO Mike Novogratz. And Mike, you kind of heard my preamble, but it's been an interesting short-term watch, particularly driven by flows into the Bitcoin ETFs. I note on the Bloomberg, there's a brilliant story about the enthusiasm for Bitcoin ETFs in Korea, for example. Just let's start the conversation with how you are and what you're thinking about right now.
Yeah, listen, you know, Bitcoin has broadly doubled since November. So let's hold this in context, right? We had a $35,000, you know, dollar price 5 months ago, and we're now $70,000. And so it's been a monster rally. That rally was mostly fueled by adoption, right? With the ETF, it made it very easy for people in the U.S. institutions and the wealth channel, most importantly, to access Bitcoin for the first time. What's happening at the same time this is happening in the U.S., we're launching ETFs with, or ETPs, I'm sorry, with DWS in Europe. We've got a partnership with Itaú in Brazil. And you're seeing people around the world participating in the simpler form of Bitcoin, right, in easier access form. And so I think this is just starting. Like, what will happen to prices? Prices are going to consolidate for a while between 75 and maybe 62 or even 58. You could see a consolidation, but you know, each 100 days, our government's adding, $1 trillion of debt, right? We're at 34 trillion right now. We'll be at 35 trillion and then 40 trillion. That story is so powerful. It makes it easy for salespeople, right, for registered investment advisors to tell their clients, put a couple percent of your net worth in Bitcoin. And you're seeing that happen. This is a process that's going to go for years, not for months.
Mike, let's then have a robust and healthy debate about this. Jack Mallers, who I'm sure you are aware of or at least know, was on the show this week talking about the same thing. He looked at inflation, he looked at debt, and he makes the point that because there are a finite volume of Bitcoin, that the price will continue going up in the context of those economic factors. The pushback that I gave him was, well, actually, if you look at Bitcoin trading, there's a lot of short-term liquidity, and the market doesn't think that inflation is going to tick higher over a medium and long-term basis from this point. So let's get back into it, where Bitcoin fits into a portfolio for an investor who is thinking about the national debt, who is thinking about what is happening with rates.
Listen, you could have bought a house in America in 2012 for $190,000, and today that number is about $400,000, right? And so when you print as many dollars as we're printing, forget what the headline inflation number looks at, because you have asset inflation that doesn't go into CPI. At times you have food inflation. And so you have lots of different inflations. The purchasing power of the underlying currency goes down, right? Look what, look how much silver a British pound gets you today. Certainly does not get you a pound of silver. The long-term history of governments is that they debase their currencies. And we're in that process. And we've got an election coming up between Biden and Trump, both who I think will expand the balance sheet. We're running 25% of GDP as a federal budget. That number should be 20. So we're 5% of GDP off of where a real good, you know, tight government would be spending. And I just don't see that changing, right? Populism is taking over the world. It's a very scary world in that respect. But Trump is a populist and Biden is a populist. We don't have a centrist in the system. And so I'm really skeptical that we're going to have a Simpson-Bowles amendment or something to balance the budget or someone to cut spending. And until that happens, it's easy to sell Bitcoin.
Near term, things are going pretty well for you and Galaxy Digital. You swung to a profit in the quarter. Reflect on that and how meaningful it is.
Well, it feels very different than it did 6 months ago, right? Our phones are ringing off the hook. We've gotten into the staking business. We'll have over a billion and a half dollars staked, which wasn't 6 months ago. We were barely in that business. That's part of our infrastructure part. Our mining, we're mining coins cheaper than anyone else, any public company and any private company I can see, because we're so well situated in Texas. So our mining business is doing well. Our derivative business is booming. Lending is picking up. People are lending us money at much cheaper rates than they used to lend us money. And institutional partners are reaching out and looking at how can we work together. And so when I look at it all together, it just feels like a different business than it did 6 months ago. We made money. We own a lot of assets. Assets went up. Our businesses made money. Our operating businesses are running profitable. And so couldn't be more excited.
Mike, just real quick, I think you told investors that work on Delaware was ongoing and a NASDAQ listing ongoing. Do you have any updates on both of those items?
Listen, what I told investors was, for 2.5 years, we have been working diligently with the regulator, the SEC here, trying to get redomiciled to the U.S. and listed on the NASDAQ. There was a change of philosophy after Jay Clayton in the last administration left and Gary Gensler in the new administration came in. And just looking at the facts, no companies that do anything other than Bitcoin have made it through as public companies. And it's been frustrating. It feels very un-American, right? That we've got this one group of companies that got public, that have access to the capital markets, that have access to cheaper funding, and we're waiting on the sidelines still. I am optimistic that things will change. You know, there's an election coming up. No matter who wins the election, I think that there'll be turnover at the regulators. I think Democrats are realizing that crypto is, you know, the American public is voting. They're voting that they really like Bitcoin, they like digital assets, and they like crypto. And so politicians usually can sense the where the wind is blowing, and the wind is blowing at the backs of the people who are engaged in crypto. I think you're going to see it as a big factor in a few elections. This, you know, John Tester's election in Wyoming, Sherrod Brown, the crypto PACs are going after in Ohio because right. They've stood in the way a little bit. And so I think the Democrats are going to learn and have learned. When I'm in D.C., most Democrats I talk to, Hakeem Jeffries, Chuck Schumer, they see this as a bipartisan issue. But it's been a small handful that have stopped any real advancement of legislation and pushing the SEC to, you know, to kind of look at this industry as a tech-forward industry, a future-forward industry, and to be fair to all the players.
It's a conversation I've had with so many of your peers. There is one other thing that I want to discuss before we let you go, Mike, which is later in the program, we will look ahead to SBF sentencing. And I just wonder how much of a bookend you see that moment for your industry and your thoughts toward it.
Yeah, listen, I think we suffered a lot of damage to trust in the end of 21, 2022. And getting that behind us is a good thing, period. I wish SBF well. Like, I spent a lot of time on criminal justice reform, thinking that sentences in our country are too long. But he did a lot of shitty things, and he is going to, you know, serve some time and deserves to. But I think it's good for the industry to move beyond that. I think we have. I think, you know, the face of the industry in some weird way went from a little kid in Bermuda shorts to Larry Fink, the head of the biggest asset manager in the world. And I think that's a very positive thing for our company going forward and in the industry.
Galaxy Digital founder and CEO Mike Novogratz with some energy this morning. Appreciate the conversation. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you. Okay, one of the biggest security incidents of the year hit the crypto sector after a hacker swiped millions of dollars from blockchain-based Munchables on Wednesday. Blockchain specialist PeckShield indicated that the hacker stole 17,400 in Ether tokens, worth about $63 million at current prices. But it seems the perpetrator had a change of heart. According to blockchain data, they returned the funds in full later that same day. All right, coming up on the program, Databricks is launching DBRX, its very own large language model. Conversation coming up with Ali Ghodsi, Databricks CEO, and of course, its co-founder. That's next. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is Bloomberg Technology.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice, or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stiefel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Okay, here's some of the other news stories that we're watching in Talking Tech. And first up, Alibaba scrapping plans to sell $1 billion of new shares in Sanao, its smart logistics unit. China's e-commerce giant called off the sale, citing poor market conditions. The move adding pressure to the financial hub of Hong Kong as it deals with a dearth in its IPO market and international capital outflows. Plus, a U.S. Commerce Department agency is calling for sweeping audits on AI systems. A report from the National Telecommunications and Information Administration now recommending that the federal government imposes consequences on AI companies that introduces, quote, unacceptable risks or makes unfounded claims. The report goes on to outline recommendations for the federal government, including creating guidelines for AI audits and creation of nutrition labels to standardize information across AI models. And mark your calendar. Apple sets a date to kick off its AI future. The company announcing its Worldwide Developers Conference, or Apple WWDC, will be held on June 10th, where they are likely to unveil an AI roadmap. Although no details of what to expect were made available, the event is expected to showcase major software updates across its product ranges, which are coming later this year. Okay, another piece of technology news. Databricks is launching its very own large language model, DBRX, as part of their mission to deliver data intelligence to enterprises and help organizations understand and use their own data to build their own AI systems. Let's bring in Ali Godsey, CEO and co-founder of Databricks, for more. You've decided to do it. You and I have talked a lot about what's happening in generative AI and the people that are building the LLMs. And at a time, you were agnostic. You said, okay, there's loads of great LLMs out there. We can pick and choose. You've changed strategy. Why?
Well, we're still agnostic. You can still use all the different large language models on Databricks, but we built DBRX and we open sourced it. Why? Because our strategy is that most of these enterprises have proprietary data, and they want to have their own large language models that understand that proprietary data. That we call that data intelligence, understanding their data. Other companies are building general intelligence. You can ask it about World War II or whatever you want, but it doesn't understand the data that these enterprises have. So for that, we have an open source model that you can customize and can own the IP, so these enterprises can own it. So companies like Rivian or Block can build their own large language models, which they are with us, that then understands their data and helps them become competitive.
So let's simplify this. Let's run with the Rivian examples. It's a company, as you know, that I know very well. You are making a generative AI tool for them where, within the confines of Rivian, it can give answers based on a prompt specific to Rivian, the company and its data. Just explain the basics.
Yeah, if you take Rivian, for instance, their AI models that are custom on all the data that they have can switch lanes, it can, you know, look at the cars in front of it, they can even optimize the energy consumption of that car, right? Custom model on their data, it's very important for them to be competitive against their competitors. Another company, Block, formerly known Square, large language model, and then you can interact when you register on their devices and, you know, you're interacting with the Square app. It now can understand, you can just speak English or any other natural language based on these large language models. So this is key to these companies. It's not general intelligence, it's data intelligence on their data.
Ali, there are loads of founders and CEOs of publicly traded companies that come on this program. They know exactly what Databricks is. You would say 70% of Fortune 500 companies use Databricks. I get it. There is a ginormous body of people in the world that haven't got a clue what Databricks is and why it's important. Explain this new LLM in the context of what Databricks does as simply as you can.
Yeah, so look. What has happened over the last 10 years is that every company on the planet is moving and outsourcing their IT infrastructure to the hyperscalers, to the cloud vendors, AWS, Google, Microsoft. Okay? They also all need a data platform. That means data that they bring in so that they can create, you know, Tableau charts and Excel charts, but also do predictions on it to predict what's my revenue going to be, which of my customers are going to churn next, when should I replace my equipment. So basically data and AI. So we are the go-to company if you want to democratize data and AI inside of an enterprise. You probably use the hyperscalers for your infrastructure of IT, but then for data and AI, we do that for you. We help you do both analytics, that's backwards looking, what was my revenue last week, but also forward looking, what's my revenue going to be next week. So that's what we do. We democratize that to enterprises.
Ali, you're an incredibly competitive person. You are doing this LLM to make Databricks more competitive, I'm assuming principally against Snowflake. This is the first time you and I have had a chance to talk since Frank Slootman stepped back, stepped down. And they brought in a more product-focused leader. Is my read. What's your reaction to all of that? What do you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think we put a lot of pressure on them, and you know, they realized that AI is important. So Snowflake basically was not doing any AI whatsoever. They're actually a great company. I have a lot of respect to them. A lot of respect for Frank, actually, who I think did an excellent job with that company. But they're primarily a data warehousing company. Data warehousing, super important technology, but it's used to ask questions about the past. You know, how did this product do last week?
It's not predictive.
Yeah, it's not predictive. So, and we've been doing, you know, AI for the last decade. So I think it shows that, you know, the puck is going towards AI. I mean, we see that with these generative AI models, with DBRX, with what everybody, you know, every CEO I talk to now, Fortune 500 company will tell me, AI is super critical for our strategy. We think that actually in our whole industry, data and AI is how we're going to become competitive. Help me do that. So, of course, it makes sense that a lot of vendors out there are kind of pivoting now and going towards AI.
Databricks CEO and co-founder Ali Goetz, it's great to have you back on the program here in SF. Universal Music has struck a distribution deal with HYBE, gaining rights to the South Korean company's roster of stars, including BTS, Lil Baby, and Thomas Rhett, along with Deepetize, the social media app Weverse. Universal signed a 10-year agreement to become the exclusive distributor of HYBE's artist music in much of the world, and will also invest in fan-centric communication app Weverse as part of the deal. Okay, this is what we're watching in the next 24 hours. Disgraced FTX founder Sam Bankman-Fried facing decades in prison and is set to be sentenced tomorrow. For what we're expecting, for what's going to happen, Bloomberg's Zeke Foe, author of Number Go Up, Inside Crypto's Wild Rise and Staggering Fall, the book, frankly, on everything FTX, SBF. The sentencing, this is a bookend to a saga that you covered closely. What are you watching for?
So the judge now has a lot of discretion to determine SBF's fate. His defense is still arguing that more or less customers will be made whole and therefore he should get a light sentence. The prosecution is saying that this is one of the biggest frauds in history. They're asking for 40 or 50 years. The judge even could go for more than that. It's really up to Lewis Kaplan. And during the trial, Sam annoyed him quite a bit, it seemed like. So it'll be interesting to see how he handles this tomorrow.
So one of the other names in this is John J. Ray III, who basically said that Sam Bankman-Fried's zero harm argument was complete rubbish. There is a lot of public pressure here. Everyone is weighing in. Will you be down there in New York City?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be at the courthouse bright and early. Reporters have been lining up, you know, starting in the wee hours to get a seat for the sentencing. So it's a bit competitive. But the weird thing to me, honestly, is how much the crypto market has totally moved on from this. It's like one of the most prominent, the face of the industry is, you know, being sentenced for a giant fraud, and people are back to trading meme coins like nothing happened.
The circle of life, Zeke Fox, Bloomberg Zeke Fox, who wrote the book on SBF, FTX, and everything else in between. Thank you very much. So that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. It is a short week, one day to go here in the United States. Recap, we had some really big conversations on the show today. The podcast is for you, Apple, Spotify, iHeart, and of course, the pod is on all the Bloomberg platforms. Thank you to everyone that listens in daily. From San Francisco, this is Bloomberg Technology.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.